Every year, we celebrate the 4th of July because of a piece of paper, the Declaration of Independence, the founding document of this country. But have you ever actually read it? The whole thing, top to bottom? Because it's surprisingly relevant to a lot of the things that we argue about today, like income inequality, the 1%, racial justice. Political philosopher Danielle Allen teaches a class that's a really close reading of the Declaration of Independence, and her students have told her that doing this, just reading and thinking about the Declaration of Independence, has changed their lives. Steve Paulson wondered how that could be.
Danielle, my guess is that most people would say they have a basic understanding of what the Declaration of Independence is about, the founding document to some degree, announcing a new kind of American identity. But my sense is that you think we don't really understand it. Do I have that right?
You do. My basic take is that we haven't really taken the time to read its argument lately. It has a philosophically coherent argument about the ideal of equality, and that's what I've really been trying to recover and draw people's attention to.
Which I don't think is the usual take. I mean, I think most people would look at the Declaration of Independence, and I mean, this is a story about freedom above all. I mean, freedom from Great Britain, more so than about equality.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it is about independence, but insofar as the text makes an argument, its argument is about equality. And that's a really important story because it explains why it is democracy is the right kind of political form.
Now, I would think in some ways, equality and liberty would kind of pull in opposite directions. I mean, equality is you're sort of trying to come up with some common rights, common access to resources for all people. Freedom kind of means you go off and do your own thing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in the last 50 years, we have really come to think of equality and freedom as pulling in opposite directions, as being, even in the language of some writers, in eternal conflict with each other. But actually, up until the early 1800s, the standard view was that equality and freedom reinforced each other, that you needed both to have either. I mean, there's a long historical story for why we've gotten to be bad at thinking about equality. And that story has to do with the challenges of thinking about economic issues in the wake of the Industrial Revolution and the massive disparities of income and wealth that accrue in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. When the founders wrote the Declaration, they didn't have the modern economy to think about. So we really face the question of trying to understand what are the egalitarian policies for running a market economy post-industrialization, post-globalization.
Can you take us through some of the passages in the Declaration of Independence? I mean, what are you looking at? I mean, what are sort of the key passages?
So if I tell somebody that I'm talking about equality in the Declaration, they'll say, oh, okay, well, I know you're talking about the second sentence, aren't you? You're talking about that glorious phrase where they say all men are created equal. And I am talking about that, but that's actually the second place equality comes into the Declaration. And we don't often notice that it comes in the very first sentence in a very different context. So in that opening, they say, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bands connecting them to another and to assume the separate and equal station among nations that the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them to, then it's necessary for them to declare the causes that impel them to the separation. So what they're developing there is an ideal of equality as freedom from domination. They've acquired the capacity to govern themselves. They've built Continental Congress. They've built decision-making mechanisms. And so they're ready to say, keep out. Don't trespass. We've built a community here, and we'd like to be equal as a community. We're not as rich as Spain and Britain and France. We don't have anywhere nearly as strong as a military. We're talking about equality because we've got the political capacity to organize our own lives. And we are equal in that regard with the most powerful state on earth.
Is this sort of a different understanding of equality than we normally have?
I think that our muscles for talking about the ideal of equality have kind of atrophied lately, you know, in the last few decades. I think we're really good at talking about liberty and freedom. We have all kinds of ready-made or sort of stock phrases about that, you know, sort of, you know, things like a man's home is his castle, and we have a sort of idea of freedom associated with that.
And we don't want government to tell us what to do.
Bingo, exactly. You know, government is a threat to freedom and so forth. And we just have so many ready-made and stock phrases. But what are our stock phrases about equality? We really don't have them anymore. And so I think the first thing you have to do actually is ask yourself the question, which kind of equality am I talking about? Am I talking about political equality? or social equality or moral equality, or am I trying to talk about something in the economic realm? And there, I think, you know, we're more likely to talk about justice or fairness or opportunity, right? But you have to really separate out those different egalitarian strands in order to even begin to know what you're talking about when you invoke the concept of equality.
You've taught this document, I know, in various places. I mean, you've taught it at elite colleges, Princeton, Harvard, University of Chicago. You've also taught the Declaration of Independence to night school students in Chicago.
Yes.
Was that a very different experience?
It was completely different and truly wonderful. The difference between the night school students and the undergraduates is that the night school students already had a lot of life behind them, and it wasn't always a pretty picture. Hadn't been an easy thing. Their lives were full of difficulty in one way or another. You know, maybe they were working two jobs, or maybe they didn't have a job. It was a class that was specifically for people who were roughly at the poverty line. Lots of health issues, sort of relatives lost to gunfire or things like diabetes. So when they came to texts like the Declaration, they brought with it sort of passionate set of questions about their own efforts to change their lives. My undergraduates at all these terrific universities have also been, you know, splendid and wonderful to teach. But, you know, for them, in some sense, you sometimes feel a little bit more as if it's checking a box. You know, yes, I've read the Declaration of Independence, check, and I'll move on to the next thing, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln. Whereas for the night students, they wanted to know, you know, how do I make my life better? How can this text help me make my life better?
And could it?
Absolutely.
Really? So
Absolutely.
How so?
So that is the brilliant thing about the Declaration, is its core argument is very simple. You know, human beings need to look around, diagnose their circumstances, figure out whether things are going well or badly for them. And if they're going badly, choose a course of action, come up with the reasons, justify it, and share that justification. And so my night students got the kernel of the Declaration a lot faster than any other students I've seen. What the Declaration offers is a certain kind of rigor of analysis. What's your diagnosis of your circumstances? What do you propose to do about it? How do you justify it? Those three steps. And so I think they found it very empowering. You know, what was the different course they wanted to set? How would they justify it?
Really? So it actually had practical value.
That's right. And the practical value ranged from students who then felt empowered to even do things just like ask their boss for a raise, right? So, I mean, there's a whole range of ways in which empowerment matters. It doesn't have to be that you're sort of taking on, say, the whole system all at once. Sometimes it was deciding to make a change of residence. Sometimes it was a decision to leave a partner, actually, and to free oneself from a set of abusive relations in order to have a fresh starting point.
But you're saying some people actually came to the conclusion after talking about the Declaration of Independence in your class?
I'm not saying that, you know, the Declaration is the only part of that story, okay? And I would never want to claim something like that. But yes, I mean, I did have students come back to me and say, there was this big life decision that I was wrestling with, and reading the Declaration and thinking about it with you helped me clarify my choices.
Now, I would think some of your students would have said, you know, the main author of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, was a slaveholder. I mean, the founding fathers created a legal system that justified slavery, this oppressive institution. This history does not have anything to do with me, or if it does, it, you know, it was in a very bad way.
Well, that is exactly where most of my students started. So, I mean, you've put your finger on it. They were mostly poor people, mostly students of color, and they did connect it to sort of dead white male slave owners. So, I mean, it's a real question. How do you get past that? And that's where I think the Declaration is so profound as a text. I mean, because its story is most fundamentally about the effort of people to change their lives. Though having said that, it matters that the Declaration has anti-slavery voices in it as well as pro-slavery voices. We give Jefferson way too much credit for the Declaration.
He's not the sole author.
Not the sole author. It's a part of a committee. He's, you know, brilliantly eloquent writer. And John Adams is the person who for the whole year had been working on the happiness concept, making the case for the happiness concept as the thing around which to organize our thinking about the purpose of government.
The unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Exactly. That's not actually Jefferson, okay? And you can, you know, the easy way to see that is look at Adams' pamphlet from April of 1776 called Some Thoughts Concerning Government, where he makes the argument that the point of government, as with the point of individual lives, is happiness, the pursuit of happiness and achieving it.
So what does that mean? pursuit
of happiness. It's so important. It is so important. So first of all, remember, Adams is from Massachusetts. He's not a slaveholder. He never holds slaves in his life. He does not think slavery is a good thing. Okay, I'll come back in a minute to what happiness means. But first, we need to know the context in which he was introducing the concept. The Virginians have begun to use the more conventional term for thinking about your rights, property. And they've begun to use that term, property, to defend slavery. And when the Virginians in May of 1776 came to write their own constitution and George Mason wrote for them the Virginia Declaration of Rights, he produced a formulation of those core rights that was life, liberty, property, and pursuing happiness. In other words, he accepted Adams' argument that he'd been making, but he kept the property term in there. So when we get to June and they're drafting the Declaration of Independence for everybody, that property term gets elbowed out. Hmm. That is an anti-slavery moment in the Declaration, and I really think we have John Adams to thank for that.
Now, if we try to put the Declaration of Independence in some historical context, was this a radically new document?
It was very radical. It's true sort of innovation, and this is when it's such a merger of Adams and Jefferson, is in that famous second sentence. It's the incredibly long second sentence, which I'm always inflicting on everybody. So if you don't mind, here
go
we
ahead.
Go. Okay. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It's that.
I'm impressed that you can just remember all that.
Well, I'm sure I've missed, mushed up some of the words here and there, but it's a theory of revolution. That's what's radical about the document.
And it's kind of radical to think about that.
It's
document of our country, yes, of course, it led to the American Revolution. But it's a revolutionary document.
It's a theory of revolution.
Exactly. A theory of revolution in today's age when, the powers that be don't want revolution.
No, exactly. That's the extraordinary thing about it. Think about founding your polity on a theory of revolution. It seems like a contradiction in terms. Aren't you supposed to found it on something that's sort of like super stable and never going to change? But the whole point of the Declaration is that every generation has a responsibility to survey their circumstances and reconsider the question of what our principles are and how we make them real through institutional form.
Danielle Allen teaches political philosophy at Harvard, and she's the author of Our Declaration. Steve Paulson talked with her.